Hey there, and welcome to the Plays the Thing, Podcast 7, The Inciting Incident and the Construction and Function of Supporting Characters. My name is Andy Black, and I'm a playwright. This podcast series is being offered in conjunction with the Play Submissions Helper website. My personal playwright's website is www.andrewblackplaywright.com. The Play Submissions Helper website is www.playsubmissionshelper.com. This podcast will discuss the inciting incident of a dramatic narrative and talk about how this concept is important for the playwright to know about and use when writing a play. I will also talk a little bit about the characters which support the protagonist of the story and things to consider as the playwright builds and develops those supporting characters. Before we get into the content, however, let me take care of a few administrative details. Each of the podcasts has a learning aid, a handout, which can be downloaded from the Play Submissions Helper website in PDF form. The learning aid that goes with this podcast is called Podcast 7, Inciting Incident / Supporting Characters. You will be able to follow along with some of the key points by looking at this handout if you like. Second, who am I? Well, my name is Andy Black, and I'm a playwright, as I mentioned before. I have an MFA in playwriting from Ohio University, and I teach playwriting at the Indiana Writers Center in Indianapolis, Indiana, where I live. I'm not going to give more information about my biography, but know that you can find out more about me if you go to my website, www.andrewblackplaywright.com. You can follow me on Twitter, where my handle is at Andy Playwright. Third, the Play Submissions Helper website, which is the series sponsor for these podcasts. Play Submissions Helper, or PSH, is a community of more than 1,700 playwrights. Its goal is to help playwrights realize the dream of getting a play produced. And the way PSH does this is by saving the playwrights hours of time searching for theaters to which their work can be submitted. For only $6.99 a month, PSH provides a compendium of hundreds of theaters and organizations that are accepting play submissions. It's the perfect system for a busy playwright who wants to focus on the craft of writing. And you can sign up now by going to www.playsubmissionshelper.com. On a personal note, I just had a play of mine that was featured in a festival in Kalamazoo, Michigan at Western Michigan University. It's called Activate Midwest. It was a great experience, and the way that I found out about this festival was on the Play Submissions Helper website. So it does work. I strongly encourage you to take advantage of that as a resource to you as a playwright. So let's get started with today's agenda, which you can find on page 4 of your handout if you are following along with the handout in that hard copy. So I've already done a few simple startups, and I'm going to talk for just a moment about the teaching examples I'm going to use in this podcast. I'll be talking about the inciting incident. What is it and why is it important? I'm going to talk about different kinds of inciting incidents that might go with different kinds of plots. And I'll talk about the importance of showing the inciting incident on the stage. I'm also going to do a special topic on supporting characters. So I'll be talking a little bit about what are supporting characters in the universe of the play, how do they function. I'm going to talk about how you can consider supporting characters as parts of the protagonist's psyche. I'm going to talk about different kinds of supporting characters who may comment on the theme of the play. I'll talk about archetypal supporting characters, and I'll talk about the importance of giving every supporting character a distinct point of view. I'll summarize at the end, and then I have some action assignments. So if you want to deepen your understanding of the concepts that are included in this podcast, you can follow along and do those assignments on your own. And the assignments are written down in the handout. So if you can listen to them in the podcast when I get to that point, or you can actually print out the handout and then do the assignments on your own. I'll talk for just a moment about the teaching examples, and this repeats information from other podcasts, but in case you forgot, or this is the first podcast you've listened to, I'll say it again. One of the challenges of teaching playwriting is it's helpful to use examples from really good plays, but not every playwright has read every play. I'm going to suggest that aspiring playwrights need to familiarize themselves with the great works and seek them out if need be. I'm going to refer specifically to 5 well-known plays or stories as teaching examples. I use Shakespeare's Hamlet, Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry. I actually use the movie version of The Wizard of Oz, which is based on a novel by Frank Baum, and it also does have stage versions. I'm going to talk about A Doll's House by the Norwegian playwright Henrik Ibsen, and then I have a musical comedy that I refer to, The Music Man, which was written by Meredith Willson. So those are the five teaching examples I'm going to be using in this podcast. So let's get into the inciting incident. What is it? The inciting incident in a theatrical narrative or a play is a dramatic event which takes place near the beginning of the play's plot. It's an event which upsets the apple cart of the protagonist, and it introduces a major dramatic question, or MDQ, which organizes and structures elements of the plot which will follow. Now, in earlier podcasts, I introduced the concept of the protagonist. And it's the protagonist whose personal journey through the narrative is followed or tracked by individual audience members. The inciting incident affects the protagonist, and the incident usually destabilizes the protagonist in some significant way. Now, in earlier podcasts, I also referred to the concept of the major dramatic question, which I sometimes call the MDQ. Not only does the inciting incident upset the protagonist's peace of mind in some way, but it also causes the protagonist to decide that he or she has to do something in order to restore his or her peace of mind. So I have called this something that the protagonist needs to do, the onstage manifestation. And from my teaching examples, it may be that he needs to kill his stepfather, he needs to open a liquor store, she may need to get back to Kansas. Those are the things that the characters in those plays think that they need to do in order to restore their peace of mind. And whether the protagonist is able to accomplish that goal or make that thing happen is then the MDQ. I've also talked about the old world order. This was in the last podcast. And the old world order defines the world of the play. And in that podcast, I talked about how it defines the world of the play before the occurrence of the intrusion or the inciting incident. So the inciting incident is the event I'm talking about today, which is the thing that actually interrupts the old world order, which is what I talked about last time. I have a schematic which shows how the various elements fit together. And if you look on page 7 of your handout, you'll see the graphic that I've created that depicts how all the key elements of narrative fit together. And the inciting incident is depicted as a lightning bolt, and you'll find it in the lower left-hand corner. And I chose that symbol intentionally because the inciting incident should strike the protagonist like a lightning bolt. Now, what I'm calling it, what I've called so far for the most part, the inciting incident, is sometimes called the intrusion. It's sometimes called the initiating incident. I think in the diagram, I call it intrusion / initiating incident. These elements are actually all the same. One thing that most theorists agree on is that this narrative element is important. They don't all agree on what to call it, which is why there are a few different names. I personally believe they're used pretty much interchangeably, which is how I'm going to be using them in this podcast. So now let me give you some examples of initiating incidents or inciting incidents from the teaching examples. In Hamlet, the inciting incident is the appearance of the ghost of Hamlet's father. And the ghost of Hamlet's father has a message for Hamlet. And the message is that he, the father, was murdered, and he wants Hamlet to avenge his death by killing his brother, the man who is now his brother-in-law. In Raisin in the Sun, the inciting incident is the arrival of an insurance check at the younger household, which is the household where the action of the play takes place. In Doll's House, the incident is the moment that a character named Krogstad threatens to tell our protagonist Nora's husband about her forgery if she doesn't intervene on his behalf and help him save his job. So the inciting incident is Nora's realization that she is being blackmailed. And in The Wizard of Oz, it's quite simply the arrival of a tornado, which takes Dorothy to the land of Oz. Now, of these five teaching examples that I've been using, I'm going to say The Music Man, which is actually my favorite American musical, has what I consider to be the weakest inciting incident. Essentially, it's the arrival of Harold Hill in River City and the somewhat skeptical reaction that he gets from Marion Peru, who most of us know as Marion the Librarian. To an extent, however, it would really be hard for the audience to tell how Harold Hill's arrival in River City is significantly different than his arrival would be in any other small town where he plans to run his con. Something is obviously different about River City because he's unable to run the con, but it's a little hard to tell exactly what that is. So that is an example where the inciting incident is not quite as clear as it potentially could be. So why is the inciting incident important? First of all, the inciting incident answers the question, what just happened that our story should start here? The playwright makes a choice about where to start the story. And the term which is used to define this choice or the specific location where the story starts is sometimes called the point of attack. Now, some theorists distinguish between story and plot, so I'm going to talk just a moment about that distinction. The story is everything that is contained in the narrative, including the exposition and any backstory. The plot, however, is what happens on stage in front of the audience. So, in A Doll's House, Nora's decision to forge documents is part of the story. It happened in the past. It's not, however, part of the plot because we don't get to see it on the stage. So in A Raisin in the Sun, the death of Lena Younger's husband is part of the story, and there's a whole idea about how he was a womanizer. That's all part of the story. It's not actually part of the plot of A Raisin in the Sun because we don't see it acted out on the stage. So every playwright has to decide where exactly to start the story. And part of this choice is going to be driven by decisions that the playwright has made about who the protagonist is and the kind of plot the playwright is working with. Another factor is the decision about how to create a major dramatic question which will drive the narrative. So, for instance, Lorraine Hansberry could have started with the death of Lena's husband. Hamlet could have started with the death of Hamlet's father. And I'm going to note, just as a sidebar here, that one of the movie versions of Hamlet, which stars Mel Gibson as Hamlet, actually rewrites Shakespeare and makes the point of attack the funeral of Hamlet's father, which is shown on screen. And there's even a scene where Hamlet's mother throws her body onto the coffin of her now deceased husband and sobs madly. So the inciting incident serves to provide the dramatic juice, which starts the plot off with a bang, whatever location the playwright has chosen for the point of attack. Now, sometimes playwrights actually second-guess their own choices about where to start the play. And one of my favorite American plays is The Little Foxes by Lillian Hellman. And after The Little Foxes was successfully produced, she actually wrote a second play about the same characters, which is called Another Part of the Forest. And Another Part of the Forest is a prequel which explains how the characters in the first play got themselves into the predicaments that they were in later in their lives. Lillian Hellman decided she wanted the audience members to understand the backstory better, and she actually turned it into a second play. The inciting incident serves as a kind of booster rocket that propels the protagonist beyond the gravitational pull of Earth and catapults him or her into theatrical outer space. Without this explosion, a protagonist's decision can seem unmotivated and somewhat lame. Frequently, I read plays, usually by students, where the hero decides to try something, but the reason for his attempt to make something happen is actually not clear. And I'm going to give an example here from one of my students' works. You know, one recent example was a play about a woman who decided she wanted to get into a relationship. That was the opening scene. And it was apparent that she had been involved in a variety of different kinds of relationships with different men before the opening. It was not clear how she had come to decide that it was now time to settle down with one special man. So as a result, this decision that she was supposedly making in the opening scene seemed whimsical and I'd say specious. And as a result, it lacked power. A strong inciting incident helps overcome this confound, and it really truly engages the audience in the hero's journey towards whatever goal he or she has set for himself or herself. Now, there's another reason for the inclusion of a strong inciting incident. By design, the audience should identify with the protagonist. And in general, audiences like powerful protagonists. They don't like victims, and they're not really interested in identifying with the character who seems like a victim. So the audience is going to be constantly assessing their willingness to identify with the hero. How much do they like him? How much are they like him or her? And if the audience suspects that the hero has tried to achieve a particular goal several times before and failed, the audience members will be reluctant to invest in that character emotionally. What the inciting incident needs to do is let the audience know that today, the beginning of the play, is significantly different than any other day in the life of the protagonist. Today is different. Now, in all the teaching examples I gave, the inciting incident, one of the things that makes them such great plays is that the inciting incident is something that's never happened before. There was never a ghost. Hamlet has never seen the ghost of his father before. The insurance money has never arrived at the younger household before. Laura was never blackmailed before. And there was no tornado taking Dorothy away from Kansas. And as I mentioned, the least sympathetic protagonist is Harold Hill because it's essentially not made clear to the audience how his trip to River City, Iowa is different than any other trip he ever made. So that actually weakens the opening of the story a little bit and lessens our investment in that character's journey and decreases the amount of suspense we have about what's going to happen to him. Now, another type of problem I typically run into with student playwrights is a play about a domestic situation where, for instance, the husband or wife is in a stale marriage and they decide to take some kind of action. Now, frequently, however, people who are trapped in difficult situations decide to take action. And I would call this phenomenon the New Year's resolution syndrome. People swear to quit smoking, they swear to lose weight, they swear to leave some kind of toxic relationship, or they've decided they're going to become a world famous singer. And then after an initial flurry of activity, they settle right back into their old habits and they haven't changed anything. These people are not really interesting. These people essentially are losers. They're failures. They're not accomplishing. They're not really trying very hard to achieve their goal. And if we're going to invest our psychic energy in a protagonist, we want to know that the hero that we're rooting for is not simply suffering from New Year's resolution syndrome. In a play, the audience needs to know that the decision to leave the relationship or to start a singing career has a real possibility of being achieved. The audience is going to be assessing the likelihood of the hero getting what he or she wants. And if the audience is suspicious that the hero will turn out to have been suffering from New Year's resolution syndrome, they won't be invested in what happens. As audience members, we need to root for the hero, and the inciting incident provides a kind of burning platform for the hero to get into action. And it's a platform which allows the audience to get excited about the quest and not be concerned that the hero is not going to follow through because he didn't really want to or because he was simply delusional about what he could accomplish. So if the design of the play is such that the hero doesn't achieve his goal at the end, the playwright has to guard against the risk of the audience losing interest in the character in the struggle. It may be that the character won't achieve the goal, but will achieve something else that is just as good or perhaps even better. It may be that the story is based on an underlying belief that the universe is inherently random and that no one actually ever achieves anything. It may be that the current circumstances of the hero in this particular situation are such that he or she could not possibly have achieved the goal that he set out to achieve. And I'm just going to say I find this last set of conditions is sometimes present in what I think of as political theater, where a statement is being made about a system of oppression. Even in these plays, however, for them to be effective, the audience needs to believe that the hero has some chance of achieving the goal. And in that situation, when the audience believes that, their engagement is maintained, their sense of suspense is maintained, and then it heightens the impact of the final outcome. It may be that the hero is the only one in the play who believes in that possibility of the goal being realized, but we as the audience members must believe it along with the hero. So that's a little bit about why the inciting incident is important and the psychological function it serves in a narrative. So I'm going to shift my focus to talking about different kinds of inciting incidents, which I'm going to link to different kinds of plots. Now, I do not intend to provide an exhaustive list of inciting incidents. That almost anything could be an inciting incident. It just depends on how the playwright uses it. I will say that in classic plays, there are classic inciting incidents. A death is frequently the kickoff to a play, because death is a situation which really changes things for the people who are left behind, and it's a situation which is non-negotiable. Once the person is gone, they're gone. So Hamlet, of course, has that very inciting incident, complete with an appearance by the ghost. The death of Big Walter Younger in Raisin in the Sun, coupled with the inheritance, of course, is another death that starts the action of Raisin in the Sun. Unexpectedly coming into money could be another once-in-a-lifetime experience which could be used as an intrusion. Supernatural elements will sometimes kick off the play. In the Scottish play, Macbeth is given a prophecy that he will become king. So this type of information being transmitted as a prophecy by these witches is another classic inciting incident. My wonderful writing partner, Patricia Milton, has said to me that there are two basic plots. A man goes on a trip, and a stranger comes to town. Now, personally, I think there were more than two plots, but this simplification reveals a classic intrusion. A stranger comes to town. Now, sometimes the stranger is an evildoer, as is Krogstad in A Doll's House, and the arrival of a mysterious stranger is frequently the inciting incident that kicks off many a story. However, a man goes on a trip, in and of itself, is not an intrusion, it's a plot. The reason the man went on the trip is the intrusion. Simply deciding to go somewhere is not in and of itself an inciting incident. Other common life events, such as a marriage or a birth, can be a transformative, one-of-a-kind life event. An old friend re-entering one's life after many years away, or simply the receipt of an unexpected letter or email, could disturb the peace of the mind of the protagonist and introduce a major dramatic question. One of my favorite theorists on narrative is a gentleman named Christopher Booker, and he relates seven different basic plots, each of which could potentially have a different kind of inciting incident. In the overcoming the monster plot, the hero typically experiences a call to fight evil. The hero may have a special skill or talent that's required, and it's even better if the hero is temperamentally unsuited to fighting evil, but perhaps he or she has a degree in mathematics, and that provides the hero with special knowledge that no one else has. And so therefore, the hero is called to fight the monster. There are many different stage versions of Bram Stoker's Dracula. Typically, Jonathan Harker is the protagonist, and the call he experiences to fight the monster is based on the monster's designs on his fiancée, Mina. Harker has a very good reason to fight Dracula, since the Count is after his girlfriend, and therefore he has a great inciting incident. A similar kind of call exists in a quest narrative, which is typically the man goes on a trip type of story. The protagonist is typically someone who would normally stay at home, and the action of questing is not something that would normally occur to him or to her. However, in the world of the narrative, something has gone terribly wrong in the world around the hero, and the option to stay home is no longer a legitimate one. I'm going to put Raisin in the Sun down as a quest plot, where the goal of the hero, Walter Lee, is to open a liquor store as a way of demonstrating his autonomy and manhood in the face of oppression and prejudice. He thinks that opening the liquor store, which is the object of his quest, is going to give him peace of mind. As it turns out, he's wrong, but discovering that is part of the thrill of that particular play. One of the other popular plots that Christopher Booker talks about is Rags to Riches. It's a plot that usually involves a younger person. And if the hero of your play is young, you have a lot more leeway with your intrusion. Many of the circumstances of a young person coming of age serve as reasonable inciting incidents. Going to college, moving out on one's own for the first time, or graduating from high school would all be good examples. In a rags-to-riches plot, something calls out to an unhappy young person to take action. In Cinderella, for instance, the prince of the kingdom is throwing a ball to select his wife, and Cinderella decides she wants to go to the ball. So it's the event of the ball being thrown that serves as the intrusion. I'm also going to put A Doll's House in this category because Nora, who is somewhat childlike in her doll's house, is called out of her innocence by the blackmail attempt. Another classic plot is Voyage and Return. And what happens in Voyage and Return is the protagonist falls into an unfamiliar world and must apply energy to getting back to where he or she came from. And this, of course, is The Wizard of Oz. Typically, the old world order for that protagonist includes him or her being in a state, which leaves him or her open to new experiences. And at the top of the story, the consciousness of the protagonist is usually limited in some way. Dorothy cannot appreciate how much love and support already exists for her in Kansas. The tornado which takes her to Oz is a symbolic one in a certain way, and it's representative of her own disarranged state of mind. In A Tragedy, which deals with the protagonist making an unfortunate choice and then suffering for it, as in Hamlet, the intrusion is the temptation to do something which, strictly speaking, is unethical or at the least a very bad idea. A ghost appearing telling you to execute an act of revenge on his behalf would fall into that category. In Jekyll and Hyde, it's the discovery of a serum which can change one's personality. Frequently in a tragedy, the temptation to play God or to take one's fate in one's own hands, as in Frankenstein, is the intrusion. So we've talked a little bit about different kinds of intrusions and how they might map to different kinds of plots. So now I'm going to talk a little bit about the importance of putting the intrusion on the stage as part of your story, or part of your plot, I should say. So as mentioned earlier, the inciting incident is an event which is inherently dramatic. It needs to be, because it's the stick of dynamite that gets the protagonist off the couch and into action. The inherently dramatic nature of the inciting incident means that the playwright should have a very good reason not to include it as part of the plot. In other words, the playwright would want to consider putting that incident on the stage. Now, it's actually surprising to me the number of playwrights who include the inciting incident as exposition or backstory. In some cases, the inciting incident involves characters who will not reappear later in the play. And I will acknowledge that one principle of contemporary playwriting is that all the characters on the stage need to carry their own weight. To justify the presence of an additional actor to play a part, the character needs to be central enough to the action, to the plot, to the theme, to justify their inclusion. In other words, they would probably have a substantial amount of stage time. And if the inciting incident involves characters who have little stage time, the playwright has to be creative. Now, in Hamlet and in Raisin, the true inciting incident is the death of the father, which is not shown on stage. Shakespeare solves this problem by making the father a ghost who reappears throughout the play to goad his son to take action. In Raisin, the death of Big Walter is symbolized on stage by the arrival of the insurance check, which he doesn't have to be physically present for. Now, one of my students wrote a play where the inciting incident was the delivery of bad news from her thesis advisor. For full dramatic impact, the news could have been delivered in person, but the thesis advisor was not really central to the play's action and would never again appear on the stage. So the playwright solved the problem by having the thesis advisor appear as an offstage character, and the news was delivered over the phone. In the play August Osage County by Tracy Letts, the inciting incident is the sudden disappearance of the family's patriarch. And it turns out later in the play that he committed suicide. Here again, once the character disappears, he's never seen again on stage. Tracy Letts solves this problem by giving the character a lengthy monologue at the beginning of the play. The character is established and lots of backstory is provided. the character nor the actor ever come back, but the character has justified his existence in the stage time that he does have. Now, sometimes I think the playwrights unconsciously avoid writing scenes that they know will be difficult, which, of course, is a very poor reason not to write a scene. I suspect that the initiating incident doesn't find its way on stage because the writer secretly knows that writing that scene would be a challenge and it's easier just to skip over it. I would encourage any writer who is thinking of not including the inciting incident to write the scene anyway, at least as a writing exercise. Then the writer can re-decide whether to include that scene or what adjustments might need to be made to allow it to be included. It may not be included at all and will then simply inform the rest of what happens for the writing of the rest of the play. Now, this discussion is not to say that the intrusion can never be left out. There may be good reasons to omit it, but the decision should be a conscious choice on the part of the playwright, not a decision that's made without considering all possible options. And I'll just say that in one play of my own, the inciting incident was burglars breaking into a house. So I decided not to show the incident because I was fascinated with the idea of an opening moment in which the lights went up and the two occupants of the house that was being robbed were tied up in chairs back to back, trying to figure out how they would escape. I sacrificed the showing of the inciting incident for an artistic reason. I also wanted to keep the identity of the burglars a mystery. The play was only 10 minutes long, so this choice streamlined the amount of plot needed to tell the story. Now, I have to confess, I never did write what would have been the opening scene, and I have sometimes wondered if I had done that, whether I might have changed my mind and put it in. And if I were to go back to my burglary play and write that opening scene with the intrusion, I might actually surprise myself by deciding it really needed to be included in, as part of the play after all. So take that for what it's worth. Finally, in classic play construction, the intrusion needs to happen early in the story. Some theorists are actually quite dogmatic and state that the intrusion must happen no later than page 10, or it must occur on the first page of a 10-minute play. No rule is quite that hard and fast, of course. In principle, however, the intrusion must happen early enough in the story so that the audience does not begin to wonder when something's going to happen. As Marsha Norman puts it, the audience wants to know what they are waiting for and when they will get to go home at the end. Inserting the intrusion and the corollary major dramatic question answers that question for them and provides them with the information that they need. So now that I've talked about the intrusion and the inciting incident, I'll talk a little bit about supporting characters. So what are supporting characters? How do they function? Earlier podcasts have talked about the protagonist, the leading character around whom the events of the play revolve. I'm going to take advantage of this podcast to talk a little bit about supporting characters, the other characters whose function is to support or inhibit the protagonist as the hero pursues the goal, or to provide a different perspective on the protagonist's character and journey as the audience tracks the protagonist. I've talked before about how the audience members can enter a trance state as they watch a play. They so completely identify with the protagonist that it begins to feel as if they are having a dream, the dream of the protagonist. Now, a principle from dream interpretation that I apply here is that all parts of the dream are you. As applied, if you have a dream about a coworker, you're not dreaming about your literal coworker, who may be named John or maybe Susan. You're dreaming about the part of yourself that is, in some way, like that coworker. So let's assume that John is very aggressive and a bully. You may be dreaming about the part of you, which might like to be more aggressive, or perhaps which is somewhat aggressive. If Susan is very creative, when you dream about Susan, you are likely to be dreaming about your own creative life or your own sense of creativity. Now, sometimes this symbolic content is called disowned material, in that we may be uncomfortable for psychological reasons with our own aggression or our own creativity, and we project it out onto others. In our dreams, we project it onto other people who serve as the symbol for that quality that we're struggling with, like John or Susan. Now, frequently, the message in the dream is for us to deal with or integrate our own disowned material so that we may become healthier, functioning people. Likewise, in plays, the protagonist should be a complex individual who's likely to have conflicting views on his or her own journey. The supporting characters then can provide the voice of those conflicting views as the hero struggles on his or her way. So if, for instance, the protagonist's goal is to spend the night in a haunted house to prove that he is a man, he might have two conflicting voices within him. There's one voice that's afraid of the task, and the other is all in favor of it. These two conflicting points of view can be given voice in a play, first as the friend who is afraid of spending the night in the house and is constantly suggesting that the trip be abandoned, and second, as the friend who does not seem to know the meaning of the word fear and is suggesting courses of action that might demonstrate foolish courage where the house is concerned. The protagonist, who is then attempting to balance these two points of view, serves as the audience member's alter ego as the protagonist tries to find a middle path between these extremes. This model is akin to the angel on one shoulder, devil on the other, which is sometimes used to comic effect in storytelling or in cartoons. Now, I personally don't write plays that have a classic antagonist, and sometimes I have people who use this term with me, and they even say to me, well, who's the antagonist in this play? To my way of thinking, the hero himself or herself is usually the antagonist. Usually in our lives, we're actually our own worst enemy. If there's an antagonist in the play, the antagonist is often the embodiment of the worst characteristics of the hero. Now, this idea doesn't mean you can't find an antagonist. So in The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy clearly has a classic antagonist, the Wicked Witch of the West. Now, actually, I think it's more interesting to think of the Wicked Witch as an underlying part of Dorothy's own psyche, maybe the part of her which doesn't want to succeed. Walter Lee has no antagonist in Raisin. And while Claudius could be considered Hamlet's antagonist, he actually does very little to stand in Hamlet's way as the prince pursues the MDQ. Krogstad could function as an antagonist to Nora in Doll's House, but although he kicks off the action with his extortion scheme, his function is actually not to stand in her way as she pursues her goal. Typically, protagonists have allies who support them on the way to their goal and adversaries who hinder them. In some interesting cases, the ally becomes an adversary or vice versa. In The Wizard of Oz, the wizard himself seems to be an adversary, but actually becomes an ally as the story unfolds. As you populate the world of your play, consider how your protagonist might have different kinds of allies and adversaries, and then write them. Another way that supporting characters function in a dramatic narrative is to comment on the theme. So, assuming that you have decided on the theme of your play, you can populate the world with supporting characters who provide different points of view on the theme. So, going back to The Wizard of Oz, Dorothy's allies on the Yellow Brick Road represent brains, heart, and courage, all of which are attributes that she might need to solve her own problem and get back home. These attributes are, of course, ones she herself demonstrates to varying degrees over the course of the story, and through the demonstrations of these attributes, she shows that she's actually worthy of finding the home that she seeks. A play about someone whose major dramatic objective is to find a romantic partner could feature a supporting character who is happy in a relationship, and a supporting character who's unhappy in a relationship, or maybe another character who's happy being single. These various permutations on the theme allow the writer to explore different facets of that theme through the supporting characters, each of whose adventures are going to comment on the protagonist's dramatic objective. Now, Hamlet, for instance, is struggling with the issue of avenging his father's death, and Shakespeare gives us two other supporting characters who are dealing with the same issue, Fortinbras and Laertes, and that actually helps give us as audience members a pretty clear idea of what that play is all about. In Raisin in the Sun, Walter Lee is struggling with the idea of what it means to be a man, and his sister Benita is struggling to choose between two men with very different approaches to their own identity. She is going through the same struggle that her brother's going through from a different perspective. Meanwhile, Walter Lee has a young son who will one day be struggling with the same decision as his father about how to be a man, and he will be making that decision partly based on what he has seen his father do. The deceased Big Walter also made choices in his life, which we actually only learn about through exposition, which again reflect on the idea of manhood in the community that the characters are all part of. So the supporting characters can comment on the theme of the play in interesting ways and help reinforce it. So another approach to developing supporting characters is to consider characters that are represent different types that appear in one's life. And there are schools of theater that are actually populated by types. The classic melodrama has the virtuous hero, the innocent damsel, and the evil villain. And there's a cartoon series which brings these types to life as Dudley Do-Right, Nell Fenwick, and Snidely Whiplash. Commedia dell'arte has its own set of stock characters, such as Pantaloon, who is usually a self-centered buffoon, the Harlequin, who is usually a clever servant. Columbine is typically a smart and down-to-earth young woman. So typically, these traditional types are characters who are very broad and allow the audience to quickly identify what types of characters they're dealing with and what their motivations and problems are likely to be. Typically, these types of characters are not used in sophisticated storytelling, but can serve as a guide to types of supporting characters to consider when putting a story together. Another similar way of looking at types is through the concept of psychological archetypes. And this concept is based on a set of ideas advanced by the psychologist Carl Jung. Archetypes draw on typical roles or prototypes that we see fulfilled by other people as we pass through our own lives. Now, for example, two of the primary roles that we experience as the protagonists of our own lives are mother and father. So frequently plays will contain characters which represent mother, father, or parent energy. These characters speak to the influence a mother or a father might have on the protagonist's journey through the play. So these archetypes could even be further subdivided into the good mother and the bad mother, or the good father and the bad father. And The Wizard of Oz actually represents these parental archetypes in its storytelling. So Glinda the Good is good mommy. The Wicked Witch is bad mommy. The evil wizard, as he appears early in the story, is bad father. And the congenial, helpful wizard at the end of the story is good father. So one way to conceive of your characters is to explore various archetypes and what might be their relationship to the protagonist in the theme of your play. Now, I'm going to provide a list of some basic archetypes. Patriarch, busybody, the false friend, the pillar of the community, the stud or the vixen, the tragedy queen, the joker, the caregiver, the tempter. In this podcast, I'm not going to explore these archetypes more fully. But you as a playwright are encouraged to explore these various archetypes on your own as a way of determining what kinds of supporting characters might you use to populate your play. This exploration can be through research on archetypes or just by watching and reading other plays and seeing how the different archetypes show up. When dealing with archetypes, it's easy to allow these characters to become one-dimensional. The busybody, or sometimes known as the Gladys Kravitz character, is often used for comic effect. However, taking the time to build a real character out of the archetype pays off, as it will enrich the play and the audience's relationship to it. No matter what source of inspiration the playwright uses for the supporting characters, it's important to consider developing characters that are well-rounded and full-bodied as a way of deepening the storytelling and engaging your audience. One last principle for effective supporting characters is to make sure that each supporting character has a distinctive function and point of view. I notice particularly when I work with teenage writers, they have a tendency to put a lot of characters on the stage, usually teenagers, and they all seem exactly the same. Interestingly, adults can also demonstrate this problem, though not perhaps as frequently. I have a student who's writing a play where the protagonist has a sister and a daughter. And in her current draft, it would be almost impossible to distinguish between those two women as they're currently characterized. Now, I've actually never asked her why she created these two allies for her protagonist. Her play is based on a real-life situation, and I suspect that the real woman whose life the play was based on had a sister and a daughter. The coaching I gave to the playwright is to find out how the two supporting characters might represent different points of view. In terms of the decision the protagonist has to make, one character could be the pro voice and the other could be the con voice. One could be the heart and one could be the head. One could be old-fashioned morality and the other could be new ideas. But the two supporting characters need to be given different voices or one of them should probably be taken out of the play. Once again, every character on stage needs to carry his or her own weight. So in this podcast, we've talked about the inciting incident, what it is and why it's important. And just to quickly review, it's the force that kicks off the story and propels the protagonist into action, introducing the major dramatic question. Its use helps the audience invest in the protagonist's journey, and playwrights should consider putting it in as part of the plot, usually early in the story. Supporting characters can be seen as refractions of the protagonist's psyche. They often comment on theme and can be drawn from the stockpile of archetypes available in other plays and from the psychological literature as well. So that concludes this podcast, podcast number 7. And in my next podcast, podcast number 8, we're going to build on what we learned here and we're actually going to look at one of my favorite topics, the plot. So in wrapping up this podcast, I'm going to review your assignments. And if you printed out your PDF, you can look on page 14 and follow along. My suggestion here is that you may want to get a playwright's journal if you don't have one already, and you can take notes in your playwright's journal that relate to these assignments. Or you can print out the handout and make notes in the handout as well. So the first challenge is to think about a play, one that you really like, and see if you can identify what the inciting incident is. The question is, what is the event in the play that seems to kick off the action and then introduces a major dramatic question? Now, once you've identified the inciting incident, determine whether the incident takes place on stage or off. I'm going to bet if it's a play you really like, it happens on stage. Now, turn your attention to the play you're working on and make sure you have a clear inciting incident. What is it? What happens to the protagonist early on in this story that disturbs his or her peace of mind, compelling the protagonist to take action? And this brings us to assignment question number 4. For the play you're working on, if you don't show the inciting incident on stage, I'm going to encourage you to write the scene where it happens and see what you learn from writing that scene. Question 5. Go back to the play that you really like and identify the characters that surround the protagonist or hero in that play. What appears to be their function? And how do they relate to the dilemma of the protagonist and the theme of the play? Now go back to the play that you're working on, and this brings us up to question number 6. List the supporting characters and see if you can describe their psychological relationship to the major dramatic question or the theme of the play. And if you're having trouble coming up with the relationship between the character and the theme, the question then becomes, how can you reshape or rethink the character to give him or her a clearer point of view and in a clearer relationship to the story you're telling? Question 7. For the play that you're working on, take the list of characters from your play. If you were to describe each of those characters using only one or two adjectives, what adjectives would you use? And if the look over the list of all the adjectives, and if the adjectives for two characters are very similar, see if you need to shift the point of view or rethink one of those characters to heighten the distinctions between them. And finally, question 8, for the play that you're working on, do a web search and find a list of common archetypes. Which of those archetypal energies may be missing from your play? If you were to add one character representing that archetype, who would it be? Or possibly, could you shift one of your existing supporting characters into that archetype? So those are some questions that will fuel your own journey as you explore these provocative topics on inciting incident and supporting characters. And I wish you good luck with identifying and finding these elements in other people's work and then developing them in your own. I love recording these podcasts. I love thinking about playwriting, and I love sharing what I've learned and my own experiences with others and hope that they find it beneficial. So I wish you good luck as you continue your own writing, and I look forward to seeing you all back again for Podcast 8. Take care, and it was fun working with you today. Bye for now.